Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is now 9:00 a.m., 9 a.m. on May 9th, 2023. Time to convene a regular meeting. Oh my gosh, sorry.
I'll start over. Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is 9:00 on May 9th, 2023. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of Commission. With us today, we have Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, Scott Jones, Chief Financial Officer, Colin Willingrock, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO, General Manager, or his substitute to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. I'll now introduce Chief Financial Officer Scott Jones, who will facilitate the discussion. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Commissioner Wolf. You get a substitute today. I'll do my best, John Harlow. First up, media update with Aaron Swain here.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Swain, PR and Media Liaison. Going to jump right into Energy Block Party. So what a great event, right? I think everybody had a great time. I'm going to brag a little bit on our CorpCom team. You know, we had great photos out there, just seeing all the customers out there that came out, from the EV car show stuff to the touch a truck, just the smiling faces of everybody. I think we were overwhelmed with the response of customers coming out. We expected maybe 500, something like that. I think we were in the multiples of thousands that came out and really, you know, got to see what we do, talk to people, learn about EVs, all that kind of stuff, learn about hydropower, things like that. So overall, just an amazing day. I put up some of our photos that Krista took, but you know, organizationally, Kelly, Laura, David did an amazing job, knocked out of the ballpark. Wendy and Kelsey with design work. I mean, just all the stuff kind of really came together. So I just want to brag on them. I think they did an amazing job. And the day was just awesome. It was great to see you guys out there, just, you know, being able to talk to customers and do all that. So overall, you know, we've heard such great ideas for next year, so we hope to do it again.
It was nonstop, people coming to talk to us. And
yeah.
So Tony, or Commissioner Olson kept saying, you should go get in with this camera. I can't leave you.
I apologize to my fellow commissioners, but I was having so much fun outside. I didn't make it to the table.
I just loved having the little more in-depth time to talk to people at the tables. It's great.
Yeah, and I think next year we might try to spread it out a little bit, maybe put a few more booths outside, just so people can kind of mingle a bit more and do all that. So we're listening to that feedback, and we hope to improve it next year.
People that I haven't seen in years
yeah.
came up to say hello. It's just wonderful.
And, you know, I worked the EV booth, and just the folks that came up and were talking to us, they were so happy that we were doing it. I mean, each person that came up just talked about how great it was. So I think it was really a great day. And yeah, I just wanted to brag on our
We're gonna need more stickers next
well,
year.
Well, I just think it was a fantastic event.
Yeah.
Hats off to everyone that worked at it. And employees brought their electric cars. We had several employees bring their electric cars. So we had a good showing of vehicles. And as you said, people would come up to you and thank me for us having the event. I mean,
yeah.
I think we own Earth Day from now on.
Yeah,
and,
I agree
you know,
completely.
It was so successful. I think it really opens up. I'm sure other organizations are going to want to come. I was thinking like Starkey Wildlife Center.
Yeah.
And there's just so many good add-ons. And it's such a good niche for us. I think it's a great time of year because there's not a lot else going on.
Yeah, we've already, you know, going into the event, we had a lot of people reach out and wanted to partner with us.
Yeah.
And this year we were just like, we're just going to do this ourselves. We're going to make sure to get it done. But next year, we definitely want to collaborate.
We're running out of room for partners. But yeah, just a whole run.
Yeah.
In case anybody didn't know, kids love stickers.
Oh, they love stickers, yes. And the little hard hats. They were out
there. We went through those so fast.
5 minutes. And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank all the employees who worked it. I mean, so many people volunteered their Saturday to come out and do it. So, you know, thank you to all of them.
Yeah.
And it also is such a, I mean, what a great outreach, right? You guys do so much outreach. We talk about many customers were just a bill.
Yeah.
Well, there's proof that we're more than a bill.
Yeah.
I went to the event. I said, you know, I never would have thought of bringing my young children to my power utility.
Yep.
So
but
people were just loving it.
Yeah. And we're going to be engaging with these customers more going forward. You know,
yeah.
they buy an EV now, you know, we're their supply for power.
Yeah.
So having these type of things where they can see us as that more
yeah.
than just a utility is huge. Right?
It's a great niche. Yeah.
And I loved the connection with Earth Day because everything we're doing is relating to protecting the Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just a promo leading up to the event. A lot of promo leading up to the event. Obviously, I think that was why we had a good crowd. Kelly worked with the Herald on a story leading up to it. We had a column in the paper talking about it. She went on a podcast with APPA to talk about it. We also have a story after that with APPA that came out. And then that day after, MyEverNews had a bunch of photos and some coverage of the event. And then Caracao was great. I mean, they not only came out to the event and, you know, brought their van, played some tunes, had their mascot out there, but all the week leading up to it, they were running promos for us and really promoting the event for us. So moving on, so Kelly worked with a reporter, a new reporter at the Herald, kind of highlighting our upcoming Hydropower Appreciation Day. Did a nice story on Woods Creek, gave the reporter a tour up there. Got a nice little story out of that. And then we also have our column in the Herald will be on hydropower. So that's coming out tomorrow. One other thing we did was put out a press release touting our outage text alerts. That was picked up in a few local media outlets. So just trying to get that news out there that we have these outage text alerts and we'll be building on them in the future. And then I also worked with Garrison Mars Group and Adam Cornelius in particular on a joint press release we did with Tacoma Power, talking about us agreeing to help fund this first phase of the Markets Plus with Southwest Power Pool. So that was a good experience. Then we also set up an interview with Dan Ketchpole with Clearing Up, and a nice story came out. Publications, just wanted to mention this again with kind of tying all that stuff together. We talked about hydropower a lot. May Wire is going to focus on hydro a lot, and we've got a nice graphic that Wendy built. We've got a bunch of other stuff in our May Wire from Grayson Steele, Employee Spotlight, to talking about spring planting and announcing our Run for Water. And then lastly, this letter is going to be going out to all customers this summer. And this is going to be kind of raising awareness about Connect Up, that it's coming, deployment's on the way. And it's really one of those things where we want to raise people's awareness that, you know, we are going to be out there installing these meters going forward for the next 3 years. This letter really has John's energy and really his excitement about the program. It touts the benefits, talks about all that kind of stuff. And so this will be hitting all customers this summer. One thing I did want to mention before I go was I mentioned the NWPPA bulletin article we did last month on women in trades. Clark PUD actually saw that, and they don't have any women linemen, but they saw it and they have an entry helper that would like to become one. And so they reached out to Paul Kiss and chatted with him about what it would take to maybe bring her up and let her learn from some of our line workers. So she's coming up this week and doing that. So it's just a great example of, yeah, some of these stories and having real world.
Where is she now?
She's from Clark Beauty.
Clark.
Yeah.
And also we had a Herald story that was above full since our last media update. It was a positive story, and I can't remember what story that was.
Was it Hydro Appreciation Day? Yeah, I think it was.
Up in the morning, see
yeah.
a story above the fold.
Yep.
It's good news.
Yeah, that was the one Kelly worked on with that reporter. It was good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron. New format, too. Next is the governmental relations team. I think it's just if you have questions today, any questions on the report?
Well, we're going to have a couple of events, legislative wrap-ups for the commissioners and anybody who's elected. A couple of things coming up, so I figured whatever is not in your report, we'll we'll get when we meet. So I hope you'll be there too.
I have no questions. I read several of the articles. It's a great report.
Yeah.
Thank you for all the work put together.
Yeah, really good.
All right. Can Anything to add? All right, thanks. Next, we've got Ian Hunter, who's going to talk about a climate commitment act.
Good morning, commissioners. Ian Hunter, power analyst in the Power Supply Group. Have a real quick regulatory update for you. This doesn't have a big presentation with it. It's kind of developing information. We got it just a couple weeks ago. We wanted to make sure that the commission was informed about this development because it's likely that you may have peers and engage in, you know, events where peers are going to be talking to you about these things. We want to make sure you have the most up-to-date information as you're almost there. So as part of the Climate Commitment Act, the CCA, better known as the Cap and Invest Program, public utilities are entitled to what are called no-cost allowances, which allow us to comply with the program at no cost to the utility because we are primarily regulated under the Clean Energy Transformation Act. We recently received our no-cost allowances, our allocation schedule for the next 4 years. If you'll recall, the commission back in December calculated the number of no-cost allowances we thought that we needed to comply with the program to make sure that we were cost neutral. That calculation came out to be about 271,000 allowances for the year 2023. We got our allocation schedule, as I mentioned a couple weeks back. We received from the Department of Ecology 247,000 allowances in the year 2023, which is about 24,000 less than we had estimated we'd be. So we're working to better understand ecology's calculation methodology. We're not quite sure why there's a delta there, but we are engaging with ecology to try and better understand so that we can come back to you and explain what the difference is and why ecology gave us fewer allowances than we calculated that we need. Just as a kind of general information, there were about 14 million no-cost allowances allocated across the entire electric industry. It's about a 60-40 split between IOUs, who got about 60% of that, those 12 million, and 40% went to publics. We, Snohomish, accounted for about 1.7% of the total allowances that went out to the electric sector. And really that's, you know, part of the fact that we are so overwhelmingly clean that we don't need that many allowances as part of the overall electric sector. So the CCA allowances, these do just cover that small portion of carbon that's in our portfolio that comes from Bonneville, which is through Bonneville's market purchases and any kind of operational marketing purchases that we may have to make throughout the year. We are looking at our internal procedures and how we plan to comply with the CCA moving forward. And as those come more into focus, we'll have more updates for you as the year goes on.
And what are the consequences of running out of allowances during the year?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What are the consequences, if any, of running out of allowances during the year?
So the compliance period is 4 years. So 23, 24, 25, 26. We have an allocation for each year, and each year we're required to retire a number of allowances equal to some percentage of our overall obligation. If you're short on allowances, you need to go out and procure those from either auctions that the Department of Ecology is holding, I believe, once a quarter, or you can enter into secondary kind of bilateral transactions with other holders of allowances to purchase them directly. The last auction, the allowances sold for $48.50 per allowance. So a delta of 24,000 allowances comes out to about $1 million, but that also depends on what our actual obligation is. So the number that we put into our clean energy implementation plan that was approved by the commission was an estimate. And so depending on how that actually shakes out in reality, that could be different. We may need more, we may need less. So we're gonna be monitoring those numbers carefully and wanting to make sure that we are 100% in compliance with the CCA, and our goal is to make sure that it is cost neutral.
The $48.50 represents what?
That's the bid price in the auction that each allowance sold for. So when the auction is run, they come to essentially a market clearing price, and that's what every allowance in the auction sells for.
Okay. So was that based on the value of the amount of reduction of the decarbonization?
It's essentially the value of the bids that are put in for the auction compliance instruments themselves. So you have entities participating in the auction to buy the allowances from Ecology. They're all putting in bids. I believe the way the auction is structured is the lowest bid is the price that's taken. And then that applies to all of the allowances that are being auctioned off at that time. And so $48.50 was the price that was settled on in the first auction period. And we would expect that price to likely go up as time goes on because the allowances are becoming more and more scarce and you're getting closer and closer to needing to comply with your obligations.
It was designed to go up over years.
Yeah, because, and you know, with the cap and invest, the cap is gradually decreasing. Exactly. And so Ecology is offering fewer allowances. And so supply and demand.
Interesting, because you could see like with a low water year or a lower water year that they might end up, bottom of line end up with a little more fossil fuel we have to take against.
That is something that we will need to keep an eye on because Bonneville's carbon intensity impacts us directly from how whatever we purchase from Bonneville. And so the more market purchases that they need to make that are unspecified increases that carbon intensity and increases our overall obligation.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Next up is an insurance renewal update from Luis Fragoso.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Luis Fragoso, manager of the risk management department for the district, and I'm here to give you an overview of our insurance program, talk about the insurance renewal process and the numbers we have now for the quotes for the next period. No action is required today. We're gonna be coming back in 2 weeks with a resolution to bind coverage. And this is the objectives of today. We're going to go over the renewal process, risk mitigation, what we do to mitigate our risk, talk about a general market update, and talk about the three major policies that create the most concern for the insurance companies, namely the property, excess liability, and the cybersecurity insurance. This commission policy, EL7, was established, I believe, or revised in 2019. And it provides for the limits that we're supposed to be carrying for liability. We have a $50 million per occurrence rich limit every year. And we also have other products as well, property, auto insurance, crime and fidelity, and cybersecurity risk. I want to publicly acknowledge all the people who were involved in this process. This is a very labor intensive process that starts in January and it runs through early May. The accounting department, HR, IT, facilities, safety, generations, all these people provide data, validate data, and just help us with the information that we need to provide our broker. We have a June 1st renewal date every year. Only one of our policies renews after that, but all the other ones expire on June 1st. We work with our broker, Gallagher Risk Management Services. They go to market for us. They provide all the information to the carriers. They provide also a cost-benefit analysis and negotiate terms with insurers. So talking about additional coverage, sublimits, and deductibles. So this is a depiction of our insurance program as it stands right now. We have multiple policies, like I mentioned before, coverage for property, and we also have coverage for casualty or liability. So property covers our assets, including human resources, and the liability covers things that the district could be found negligent for or liable for. We have different levels of deductibles as well. And when you see the term self-insured retention or the acronym SIR, that refers to the deductible as the equivalent of your deductible on your personal policy for auto or homeowners. This is a great chart that I believe you saw last year. This is the updated one. Climate.gov provides this information. And as you can see on the right, the number of national events, I'm talking about catastrophes, climate, weather events in the US has decreased. In 2020, we had 22, and then it went down to 20 in 2021 and 18 last year. So the frequency is decreasing. However, the severity is increasing dramatically. 2020 was $95 billion. Last year, it went up to $165 billion. So because this affects the property and the carriers that we have insurance with, Aegis and EIM, or the insurance, the industry mutuals, anything that happens on the West Coast to the other utilities affects us and all the premiums that we pay for the coverage that we purchase.
I do have a question on this map, or maybe I'm misreading it, but this is only for 2022, is that correct?
That is correct.
Because I was thinking of the major weather issues, flooding in California. That wouldn't be that.
That would not be if it was not in 2022, and if it not exceed $1 billion in operating costs.
Okay, all right, thank you.
I've often wondered, and I've asked the question before, but I think I know the answer, but it would be so good if we could focus a little more on the West. I mean, if we had a company that could help us and without having to take the brunt of all of these central and East Coast calamities or catastrophes. We do have the wildfires. We don't, except for the floods in California. I don't know, it just seems like we're having to take the brunt of a lot of other parts of the country that we don't share the same risk. The same risk.
That is correct. Right.
But
it's called subsidizing.
Well, you know, for sure, it's a good point I've brought up before, the idea that it's possible to have a risk pool.
Yeah.
The Utility Northwest risk
pool. We do that in school districts.
That's what schools do, that reduce their.
Do that, yeah.
Some cities do that as well.
We also have the risk of earthquake, which we have very often.
Well,
when they do, they're pretty expensive, so I'm sure they're aware of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about a little bit about the property insurance coverage that we carry. We have really good limits, $400 million with a $1 million deductible, except for our water systems. We managed to pay a little higher premium last year. Their deductible to $250,000. We also have sublimits for some natural disasters like earthquakes, floods, for example. And there's a $100 million sublimit on damage to dams, pipelines. And our transmission and distribution lines are not covered under this coverage. It would be very expensive to include that. So that's why we decided not to do that. Now, in terms of the claims history for the district, we had a couple fire losses in 2003 that totaled $1.2 million in damages. In 2013, we had a water loss here at the EB in the annex that was almost $700,000. Since then, we haven't had one, knock on wood. And these are some of the things that are affecting the cost of the premiums. Climate change, it is undeniable. It is getting hotter and drier. I believe later this week we're going to break 90. This is expected to break some records this week. In the Pacific Northwest, we love our trees. Unfortunately, such concentration creates issues, concerns for the insurers because of wildfires, as you mentioned before. We have economic inflation that's creating upward pressure on prices, supply chain issues. We're not able to get goods and services quickly, and labor. In 2021, it is estimated that over 40 million people quit their jobs. And a lot of those people have come back to the job market. However, that pressure is still being felt. And our contractors, our vendors are passing the higher labor cost onto the district. One very concerning event that we are keeping really close tabs on are the attacks on substations throughout the nation. December, Christmas Day last year, there was an attack on four substations in the area in Pierce County, and two of them belong to Tacoma Public Utilities. And it is estimated they're gonna pay about $3 million for those damages. All this is creating, again, upward pressure on premium cost for everybody, not just us.
Can you go back to slide 8, real quick? Previous slide. So when you were talking about inflation, I was wondering about our limits of coverage. And how often do we look at whether our limits are correct for, do we look at if our limits are correct for today? I'm just thinking about inflation. It affects insurers when they're when something's under the limit, but it affects us as to what limit we need.
Yeah, and we do work with our broker Gallagher. We look at these numbers actually yearly,
okay.
And we decide whether it makes sense to increase the limits, maybe 500 million. Then is it worth it if we increase the limit? How much is going to cost us in additional premium? And whether it would make sense also to increase the deductible. There's been some talk from the carriers for us to increase the deductible. And
yeah.
But the problem is the premium would still go up a little bit.
Right.
So yeah, we look at that and Gallagher provides a cost benefit analysis. So
the insurance for here is for dams. That's to repair the dams if they're damaged.
That's correct.
Not the liability from and fails, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, this would be first party coverages. So the buildings and contents as well.
I have a question about things here on this slide. Transmission and distribution lines, the ones that are owned by BPA, are they covered under the Department of Energy, or are they, who pays for damages or loss of distribution lines?
Yeah, I do not know the answer to that, but I would assume that they are covered by the government.
Probably work through the rates.
Yeah, I mean, largely that's just a risk that we take on. I mean, the challenge there is, transmission distribution lines are very expensive,
yeah.
And the network it's quite a complicated network. In order to get an insurance carrier to cover the value of that is very, very expensive.
Sure.
And also, we're constantly outworking on those assets, and so. Most utilities kind of take on that as a part of their own coverage because the distribution lines that may enter the lines, storms, all those things, you're kind of working on those things constantly. So getting a provider to cover it is very difficult. Louise, one other quick comment on Commissioner Logan's question. The other thing you also see in these limits, and it depends on what you're talking about, but sometimes the carriers just won't cover above a certain point for certain types of assets. And so we could, in some cases, go back and say, hey, we'd love to get 150 or 200 or 500 or whatever. But just because of the nature of the business and their actuarial models, they may not go above a certain point for certain types of things. You'll see that in some kinds of natural disasters. You'll see that in terrorism sometimes. You see it in cyber sometimes, where there's just a limit because there's a lot of uncertainty on the high end of what the damages, the magnitude of damages can be.
You know, speaking of natural disasters, I imagine some of these areas potentially in a natural disaster FEMA would help pay for. I mean, it may take years. Does that factor into the decision of, you think about what FEMA might eventually cover when we're looking at our levels?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't believe that's a consideration that we talked about recently. Yeah, we can find that out.
No, I mean, since I've been here, the FEMA interaction has not come into the equation. Part of it's because it's just very uncertain, right? I mean, a storm's got to see a certain threshold, and then there's approval, a series of approvals, and everything else. And a lot of times it falls in that transmission distribution coverage area. So that's not a carrier covered area.
Right. On a routine basis, I was thinking something like earthquake.
Yeah.
Something like that. We have $100 million of earth movement. Assuming that's earthquake.
It is.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, and a catastrophic, I mean, so think about Hurricane Sandy a few years ago in New York. There was a tremendous amount of money that came from the federal government. There was a lot of insurance claims that they kind of waved back because they got 90 cents on the dollar for a rebuild. They got another, 50 cents on the dollar on top of that for resiliency rebuilds and stuff. So the carriers pulled back on that coverage. fresh on my mind because I just saw a presentation about this.
Do you know if we're affected by what's happening in Canada? I noticed on the news that there's some out of control wildfires already in Canada. And do you suppose they're also covered by some of the same companies?
We could be affected in the future. Mm-hmm. I know that it takes a while for the actuary to work those numbers in. Mm-hmm. Those increases that we see, they usually lag a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have what's called a quota share policy. We have five carriers that share the $400 million that we have in coverage. I'm sorry, and they share anything from 8% to 30% of limit. They paid out in proportion to those percentages. We've also asked our broker to reach out to other markets, other than talking to the incumbents, to talk to markets in London to see if they would give us a quote. Fortunately, you know, it's a capacity issue. A lot of carriers don't want to write municipal risks anymore. So they're either pulling out of the state or just refusing to write it if they are still here. Last year, we increased our retention from $250,000 to $1 million. We actually had a very good significant decrease in the premiums. In terms of the excess liability, this pays for damages to other people's property or injuries. We have a policy limit. We have two layers of insurance. The first layer is with Aegis, and they pay, they cover the first $35 million. Then we have another layer on top of that for another $15 million. So as an aggregate, we have $85 million in liability coverage, something we're to have in that we were responsible for.
Who covers the upper part?
EIM, Energy Insurance Mutual. Have $10 million in the fund in case there are any large claims. And just to give you a little background, in the last 10 years, we've had three large claims. Those three large claims, including defense costs and attorney's fees, exceed $15.5 million. Because we had insurance to cover those risks, we only pay our deductible. Insurance companies kick in the rest. So that would have been a lot of money to pay out. To do it ourselves. Some of the factors impacting the liability coverage, increased litigation. This is in general, not just against the district, but we are seeing more litigation. The venue, Washington, is known as a pro plaintiff district or venue, and that's why a lot of insurance companies don't want to write here anymore. It is more difficult to now get a judge to dismiss a case against a defendant. It is becoming a lot more expensive to defend. The type of cases that we would see or the claims that we would see against us are very expert intensive, and we have to hire specialized counsel to handle those claims. So we have what's called the deep pocket rule in Washington State. Attorneys are always trying to find a corporation with the largest coverage, and they're targeting municipalities. Social inflation, people are having less trust in corporations, and they're returning large awards against municipalities, and that affects our premiums as well. Just a couple of examples, because municipalities are afraid of trying cases right now, they're agreeing to settle claims for a lot more money. They put a premium on those settlements now. A few years ago, PG&E settled a claim for $13.5 billion, and last year alone, they agreed to pay an additional $55 million in penalties, and those penalties are not covered by insurance usually. So that was money that they came out of their funds. We just found out about this case in Los Angeles where a father and a daughter got electrocuted in their backyard, and the Department of Water and Power agreed to pay $38 million to settle those claims. So we've asked our broker to reach out to the market and see if we can find a better cost for our policies. We have insurance Aegis, Associated Electric and Gas Insurance Services. They insure 98% of the utility district. And they work in tandem with EIM. So EIM has what's called a form following policy. So whatever Aegis provides for, coverage for, Iridium will follow, which is great. You know, we have very specific risks that we have. And so we're happy to work with them. The broker also tried to reach out to other carriers. The problem with that is we were to take away the policy, the casualty policy from EIM and Aegis, then we would have to purchase separate policies for other things that are already included in those policies, like pollution and wildfire and employment practices liability. Just to give you an idea, if we wanted to purchase liability insurance for $35 million with a different carrier, the cost for $100,000 of coverage would be $1 million. So I'm sorry, it would be $100,000 per $1 million of coverages. So the premium cost for the liability policy alone would be over $3 million. Then we would have to purchase pollution coverage for an additional $500,000, and then also employment liability, employment practices liability for whatever much it is. Right now, we are paying approximately $2 million, so we're saving some money there. In terms of cybersecurity, we have a current coverage of $5 million per occurrence with a $750,000 retention. Cybersecurity policy covers three things: cost of a breach responses. It also covers coverage for third-party and first-party damages. Third-party is when someone is damaged because their information was stolen and it was misused. First party damages, restoration services, stuff like that. Again, it comes down to the cost. Ransomware is a big deal. In 2021, it was a $2 billion industry, and it is expected to go up to $265 billion by 2031. Average recovery cost of data in 2021 was $1.85 million. Data breaches, very expensive as well. The cost to restore the systems, 2021, the average was $4.2 million.
System.
Claim. And again, this is a market problem, supply and demand. There aren't enough carriers that are willing to write municipalities. And unfortunately, they group the district with other cities, counties, and they believe that we don't have the resources, the staffing to prevent attacks, cyber attacks, that we don't have the money to update our infrastructure, or software, or hardware as well. So, a little bit of bad news: the incumbent Aegis is going to maintain the $5 million limit on cybersecurity. That is asking us to increase our retention to $1 million. If you recall, premium, the deductible went up from $250,000 to $750,000 last year. It is now going up to $1 million. There will be no change in our breach response. We still have $5 million in coverage and $5 million for third-party liability. The sublimit that we have is for contingent business interruption that is reduced to $500,000. And just an example, if BPA suffer a cyber attack and could not provide us with the electricity we need, then we could make a claim with our carrier, but the limit would be reduced to $500,000. This table shows all the quotes that we have received so far. The one in red is not, it's just an estimate. We don't have a formal quote on the property program yet. I know the markets are still looking at everything that we provided. The bottom line is our premiums will probably increase single digits, 9.9% as of last time I checked this spreadsheet. Keep in mind, please, that last year the inflation rate in the US was 8%. And it is running about 5% this year. So while it is a big increase, it could definitely have been worse.
You mentioned the number in red, but actually aren't all of these, you're looking at them up until
the last minute. So what we see here, what we bring forward for approval, we can get them.
Correct. So all these quotes, we are still working with our broker. We'll continue to negotiate on terms and deductibles and hopefully the premiums as well. So by the time we come back in 2 weeks, the premium you're seeing there will be at least, should be lower than that.
Yeah, and it could even get lower than that. After, I mean, typically what you all will give us is an approval based on the best numbers we've got at the time. We'll negotiate until the last possible second, and we'll sign off on the renewals at or below that number. So every once in a while, we get a little bit of improvement in June. It's rare, but that happens.
Yeah, we're using a very conservative formula for the property coverage. We're adding a percentage to account for inflation and the expected increase in premiums.
One question I had, maybe it doesn't apply here. You spoke to looking at these things and all the things under consideration in terms of a recommendation to the board. Is probability for this utility included in that?
Probability of occurrence?
Yes. So the actuaries, the underwriters, they look at our history, claims okay. history, and also the things that we do to prevent something from
okay.
happening.
Okay.
And that is reflected in the premiums.
Okay.
Yes. It's one part of the puzzle. There's a lot of things that go into it.
I know that cities that have protected their water sources have better rates for bonds and things like that. So I think that would possibly apply to us too, protecting our water sources. Although we get it from Everett, so it would be Everett that would be more affected. But I don't know, I just think about having those protections that will give you better rates long term. Cities that have, like maybe LA, that have not really protected their water sources. They're dependent on, you know, the Colorado River and things like that. They're really hurting, I'm sure, for future water.
And just as a side note, this year we received a request to complete a 47-page survey for our cybersecurity program,
uh-huh.
and Kevin Johnston was integral in getting that information to me, and then I gave it to the broker. But that's one of the things that they were looking at, you know, what are we doing to prevent things from happening? So we have a really good plan, people who are really good at what they do, so.
So, I mean, that's a great point. We really have great people and know what they're doing and how to reduce our risk. But I guess to what extent does our insurance company, our insurers understand that? I mean, they understand our dam safety protocols. Is it more than just filling out a report? Do they do on-site business? Do they have experts to actually look at our information and say, yeah, we're at the top of the, you know, we're at the top, or we can use improvement, or?
In fact, they do. Last September, we conducted what's called engineering inspections of our hydro project, Jackson. The insurance company sent an engineer, and our broker sent their own engineer, and we walked around the entire project. And they noticed some things that needed to be fixed or changed or improved, and there was nothing major. There were very minor recommendations. If you fail the record, there were only two. They came to the EB, and they also went to ops. So they do that every year.
Yeah.
And they also have access to submit a wildfire mitigation plan. And we did that a couple years ago. So we work with a broker to get those things done.
The wildfire, it was two or three years ago, but the risk that came out of that just a couple years ago in our renewal, we met with them for hours and had a lot of folks and experts on our side and experts on their side just to really walk through in a really detailed way about our mitigation plans, the risk and all that. So they definitely lean in pretty heavily on getting into the business. And Kevin's a good example. Kevin works on the IT side for Christie Sterling. And we have, in my estimation, and this is coming from a world that was very focused on cyber, we have a very good cyber prevention and awareness posture here. And it's a lot of compliment to Christy and Kevin and others, but it helps us. There's a lot of uncertainty on the cyber insurance side, but we, I would say, I can tell you that the people I used to work with in DC said that Snohomish has a very good reputation for their cyber awareness and cyber posture. It was a nice compliment before I came here. So I think we're doing everything we can, and that's a lot of compliment to those folks. But the amount of uncertainty in that piece of our portfolio is very high.
We're very fortunate with that team of cyber folks.
And I guess that's where I was going with my questions is the good work we do reflected in a reduced premium compared to others?
Yeah, I've been dealing with cyber insurance premiums since they first came out, and they have been steadily up regardless of the degree to which your hygiene, your cyber hygiene. And you can see on the slide that we've talked about the amount of uncertainty. Every year that we go into cyber, and this predates Snohomish even for me, every year there's more exclusions, there's pressure to increase the deductible, there's pressure to push down the top limits. It's just year after year after year because the amount of risk that just keeps going up. So we're doing our dead level best to let them know how good we are at this. Christy and Kevin and others are doing a great job. And I think it's probably remarkable that we have a 5.6% increase just in that line item with all the risk that's there.
And just to emphasize the point about IT, you probably noticed that I did not include any claims in that slide. That's because we haven't had a cyber security attack or anything like that. Yeah.
Why is the increase so great? Again, for property, whatever. I mean, that is the biggest increase.
Yeah, and that is estimated, and we're using a very conservative formula because we don't have a formal quote. We expect it to be lower than that. We did not want to give you something that when you see it next time.
That's a huge.
Yeah, however, it is in line. I've talked to PSC, I've talked to Grand PUD and other carriers on the eastern side of the state, and they're all seeing the same type of increases.
It's that map that we talked about with all those very large multi-billion dollar claims. That's what's feeding that line item. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to continue to work with our broker, get the best quotes, the best rates, and the best terms for our policies, and then we will be coming back in 2 weeks with a resolution requesting approval to allow us to bind the coverage and purchase the policies.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great presentation. I actually was fearful of being more than that, but you're all the inflation.
Thank you, Luis.
Commissioner, can we take a few minutes break?
Okay. The time is 9:48 a.m. And we'll take a 5 minute break. And that will be 9:53. It is now 9:53, and we are resuming our meeting of the commission. We're going on to renewal of, you want to take it from here?
Either way, Commissioner. Ian, you're back. Go far. Ian's going to talk about a third-party operator. So.
You get rid of me that easy, commissioners. Again, Ian Hunter, power analyst in the Power Supply Department. We're going to be talking today about third-party operating reserves and the renewal of the contract that we have with Seattle City Light. And this might be a personal best because I don't believe the word carbon appears once in this presentation. So a little bit of a departure from what I'm usually talking about. So we'll talk a little bit about what are operating reserves. We'll talk about what the cost of providing operating reserves is. We'll talk about the history of how we've treated operating reserves, what we've done in the past, and then we'll talk about what our existing agreement is and what we plan to do for the future. So
First question you might be asking, what are operating reserves? So in order to maintain grid reliability, balancing authorities have to set aside a certain amount of generation to be able to quickly respond in the event that a generator in their service territory goes out or has some kind of reliability event. That reserved capacity is called operating reserves, and it comes in two flavors. One is spinning reserves, where you actually have the generator on, it's spinning, it's ready to go, just needs to be engaged and immediately put energy onto the grid. And then there's supplemental reserves, where the generator is on standby, but it's not immediately ready to be interconnected into the grid. So there's about a 10 to 15 minute window there where those reserves could be called on. Snohomish resides within Bonneville's balancing authority, and we are required to provide our share of operating reserves for our load and our generation. Bonneville's business practices allow for the third party provision of operating reserves. Otherwise, Bonneville would just provide service as part of their transmission product. How much operating reserves is required? Because of a reliability event, you may be faced with needing generation at a moment's notice. And so what the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, or WEC, requires is that each entity within the BA has to set aside a capacity equal to whatever that amount is in 3% of their load and 3% of their generation. So whatever load an entity has in a balancing authority, you have to have 3% of that set aside. And then whatever generation an entity has in a balancing authority, 3% of that has to be set aside as well. Our maximum operating reserve requirement hasn't exceeded 79 average megawatts during the last period of the contract that we've had with Seattle City Light. Just to kind of give you a sense of where we're at.
How often or how much have we called on our operating reserves, if at all?
It's fairly rare. I believe in the time we've had the Seattle contract, which goes back to the early teens and 2012, maybe once or twice. So now that we know a little bit about what they are, why they are, how much do they cost? The rate for operating reserves, it depends on the provider, how they value that capacity, holding that capacity back. There's going to be a different price tag depending on how much and what resources the entities have to provide those resources. Bonneville's rate for BP22, which is our current rate period, came in at about $11 for spinning reserves and $7 for supplemental reserves, which makes sense because it's more expensive to have a generator actively running and ready to be interconnected than it is to have it sitting idle but still ready to go. Seattle City Light historically has offered a discount with operating reserves products to the full BPA tariff rate. So the way that the historic contracts have been structured is you look at whatever Bonneville's rate case rate is, and then there's a flat discount to what we would pay Seattle.
So is that an at cost model for Bonneville?
It is.
So that means others are using, even if we're not using our reserves, others are?
Not exactly. So when Bonneville calculates its costs, it basically has to look at its entire balancing authority and say, if we had to hold back the reserves, this is what it would cost. And that's the rate that they embed into their rates. We have to give notice to Bonneville in advance if we're going to be providing a third party provision of these reserves, so they can then back that out of their calculation when they do it for the next rate period.
So they're not looking at their historical cost or providing of the actual cost covering this obligation. They're looking at what was sort of a worst case scenario.
Right, because it's a capacity value, they're not really looking at how often it's actually been deployed. It's more the value of the energy that they're setting aside as kind of an opportunity cost. Our annual cost for operating reserves has historically been about $4.4 million. So that's the all-in cost for both spending and supplemental. A little bit of history on how we've met our operating reserve obligation. Previously, under our subscription BPA contract, we were able to self-supply operating reserves using our Slice product. When we moved to regional dialogue, Bonneville said you can no longer use Slice for that, so we had to look for other alternatives. We entered into a contract with Seattle City Light, to provide those operating reserves at the beginning of that regional dialogue contract. And we've been renewing that agreement every 2 years ever since. Our current agreement is a 2-year agreement that coincides with Bonneville's rate period, and it expires coincidentally with Bonneville's rate period September 30th of this year.
So is that part of the 2028 negotiation?
Not explicitly. So this is a transmission product that is provided. And so 2020 is mostly focused on power at the moment, although transmission will be a subject of discussion in the future for sure. So what's the current agreement structure? We talked a little bit about Seattle's kind of flat rate discount. So what Seattle provides to Snohomish is 100% of our operating reserve requirement. So whatever operating reserves we need, no matter the amount, Seattle would provide them if Bonneville came calling. In the event that that call does happen, again, Seattle provides all of those reserves. The way that the agreement is structured, however, there's a cap on the price that we pay. So up to 98 megawatts of dispatch, we pay that kind of flat rate minus a certain amount compared to Bonneville's rate. If we were to ever exceed that 98 megawatts, then we would pay a $20 per megawatt surcharge. So it's kind of a way for Seattle to say, you know, this is roughly how much capacity we think we would need to plan for you guys in maximum. But if you do exceed that, we would provide it, but there would be a pretty hefty surcharge. So as I mentioned, we haven't exceeded 79 average megawatts in, or 79 megawatts historically. And so we don't think there's much risk, at least in this rate period, of exceeding that 98 megawatt threshold. But again, Seattle would meet our obligation no matter what size it ends up being. And the price that we've seen historically is 54 cents per megawatt hour less than the full VPA rate. So you take those prices that you saw for spinning and supplemental, knock off 54 cents, and that's the rate we pay Seattle. And historically, I believe that saved us about $400,000 with going with Seattle as compared to Bonneville per year. So the recommendation, power scheduling has looked at other providers of third-party operating reserves, and right now Seattle is pretty much the only game in town. They have some surplus capacity that they're able to offer into the market. That they're able to use for this purpose, and we have a pretty good partnership with them historically. And so they've offered identical terms and pricing, so no change to the structure of the contract, no change to the discount rate. So we staff recommend renewing that agreement, and we would be bringing back at the next commission meeting a resolution and the actual agreement attached in the packet for your review.
Okay. And this, again, is a 2-year
contract. Yes, it's a 2-year contract. So it would, again, coincide with Bonneville's rate period. And see you again in 2 years to talk about operating reserves.
I don't know if it's really relevant, but I'm thinking about what is it like for Seattle City Light? Do they do this for other communities, you know? Or is this a part of their business model that they, so they make money on this? I mean, they have additional revenue.
Presumably, I can't really speculate on Seattle's business model. To answer your first question, I don't believe they offer it to other utilities, or rather, other utilities don't contract with them for third-party operating reserves.
I see.
If I were to guess, I would say that this is probably the highest value use of their capacity at this time that they can enter into. So they have some surplus capacity, and this is kind of the best way that they can monetize that reliably and get kind of a steady stream of income. That'd be my supposition, but I don't know for sure.
That you're right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
I have none.
Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you, Ian. Next up is Tim F. Talk about a customer repair policy for our Connect Up program. Tim, you have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Oh, I can do it.
This is kind of a follow-up to that meeting that we had earlier in which you showed us a lot of pictures.
I did. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
So good morning, commissioners. Tim Epp, program manager for our Connect Up program, our AMI program. And I'm here to talk about a customer repair policy. It has been. Aside from that, that discussion that you mentioned, Commissioner Wolf, it actually has been 3 years since we discussed, we brought the repair policy to the board for attention. It was part of a large, very large presentation that we gave back in 2020. What I would like to do this morning is talk to you a little bit more about the background and walk us through the policy that Colin and team have helped us prepare on this. So our existing customer service regulations and electric service requirements make clear today the line of demarcation between what is the district's responsibility and what is our customer's responsibility. During the course of replacing meters, and this isn't just about AMI, this happens anytime we're out swapping out meters just due to age. It is not uncommon for a utility to discover issues behind the meter. Most of these issues that we would encounter in the course of doing connect up meter replacements would actually be the customer's responsibility under the existing policy. There are some situations that we could encounter in the course of this that would result in a customer experiencing an extended outage while they have to contact an electrician, bring them in, and this would leave customers in a pretty bad situation. And that's not really core to who we are and what we're trying to do as a utility, providing quality and a reliable electric service to our customers. So what we are proposing is a temporary policy that would cover a significant amount of repairs for customers during this time of AMI meter replacement. We did identify this back during the business case work that we did. We set aside $850,000 for repairs. And you can see on the picture, here's an example of a very common repair that could be needed. In this case, there are little claws, little pincher things there, four of them, and you can see they're actually burn marks on several that would need to be replaced. That is a very common repair that is
hard. Can you go back to the
yes.
previous slide? I mean, I know you're on a 2 minute limit. About slide three. So this is a great illustration. So if power comes into a home underground,
yes.
Can you sort of describe who owns what in that situation?
So in that situation, it is the utility, it is us that own that wire coming up to the meter base. And so there are situations where the ground may have settled, that wire is pulling the base down and maybe pulling the meter base off the side of the house. In those cases, that would typically be our responsibility to repair. So we do want to make sure that we're not impacting customers any more than is absolutely necessary for this deployment. So we're recommending temporary policy for the duration of the AMI deployment be set up. It'll help us stay on track, make things efficient, not just lower the impact for the customers, but also keep our deployment process going smoothly and more efficiently. Of course, it will require that we keep some limits in place. This is not going to be a blank check. I have included the proposed policy language in the slide deck that was provided to the board. And this first section here, section A under 5.3, kind of memorializes what is driving this need for a temporary policy. And I think that's a really good thing to help us remember down the road why we put it in place. In the next section, it calls out the need and also identifies some typical examples of what could be repaired in that. But it also, section C, identifies where we are going to draw a line and say some of these situations will not be covered There is language in here that allows the district some room for discretion. And our customers always have available our an appeals process to make sure that, they're getting what's really needed. Final section, sections D and E, we will make sure that we do need to hire an electrician in order to make these repairs. That is required for the nature of the repairs that could be made. This section makes it clear that the electrician will be responsible for the liability that, may be incurred there. And then section E makes it clear that this is a temporary policy and will be closed out at the end of our deployment, which we project to be in early 2026. In order to execute on this, we will be needing to contract with an electrician. So we have a team that's working on an RFP right now. It will include some expectations around response times that we want those electricians to have when servicing customers for us. And then it will kind of preset pricing. We'll have a menu of repairs so that each and every repair doesn't require an estimate by the electrician to be haggled over. Additionally, we have a consent form that in some cases, when the repair is a little more significant, we want our customers to understand that it is, if there is any issues rise out of that repair, that they need to work with the electrician to make that, keeps the district in the clear. So the next steps, actually we'll be back in a couple of weeks with any changes that need to be incorporated, but we'll have a resolution with the policy to be incorporated into the customer service regulations. Step back and see if there are any questions from the board.
So we have a list of certified licensed electricians. And recently I had a great electrician come through, and he's not on your list. So I've told him you should go online and apply to get on there. And he's
absolutely.
So I wanted to give you his name. Personally, not publicly.
We will absolutely add him to the bidders list.
Yeah, he's on the bidders list.
Yes.
Two questions. My understanding of the read of the temporary suspension or whatever of regs is that temporary repeal relates only to work associated with Connecta.
That is correct. That is correct. And I believe that is called out in the policy here.
Probably. I just wanted to clarify my understanding of this.
That is correct.
And Commissioner Wolf raised the issue of preparing the list of pre-qualified or whatever electricians. And I didn't see other than licensed in your criteria, so I'm assuming that when you're reviewing those proposals, you'll have some identified some basic criteria that you will use for all of the applicants.
Correct. This will be a standard District Public Works contract.
Oh, it will? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
So, Jim, great presentation. I'm glad we can do this for our customers. I've got a question about the time that someone's power could be out. So I imagine if we roll up and we see something that's obvious, we won't do anything until an electrician can fix it. But in an instance like that slide you showed, once we take the meter off and we find a problem, our electrician is going to be available to respond that day.
Yes, we're the expectation will be within hours. Okay, within good. I believe it's a 2-hour period we're asking for, so that. Correct. Yeah, we don't want to leave our customers out any longer than we have to.
Great. Just a quick couple of comments. Huge thanks to Tim and his group and the Connect Up team, really doing a phenomenal job as they navigate some of these tricky questions. This is one that we have confirmed utilities across the country, including our neighbors at Tacoma and some east side utilities. And this is essential and foundational to getting these implemented. It makes our system safer, it maintains reliability and assurance for our customers so we can officially put these in. This is a great solution. It's not necessarily a repeal of the regs, it's an addition, a temporary amendment or addendum in 5.3. So we'll add a small section that allows us to do the repairs just as part of the connect-up installation. So it's not, generally speaking, work that's going to be done on every new construction or new home, only for implementing and facilitating the connect-up installations.
Plus, it's just really good protection for us legally.
Well, safety and reliability.
And safety,
safety
of course,
and reliability is our focus.
They're related.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I believe that you, somebody presented to us, I think it was the last project presentation, that you were able to ensure that the work was not considered to give the public funds. I think I recall somebody said that.
Yeah, this is fundamental to our ability to be able to transmit and distribute electrical energy.
Yeah, yeah.
Connect up program and the new technology is going to be foundational to what we do as a utility for our customer owners. And so we believe that this is not only consistent with our mission and our strategy and strategic plans to be safe and reliable, but also allows us to provide those essential services that our customers depend on.
Right.
Thank you, Commissioners.
You let me off like this.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you have anything more for us before we recess into executive session?
No, ma'am, I don't think we do.
Okay. It is now 10:16, and we will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation. And we will reconvene here at 1:30, right here in the commission meeting room. And virtual participation is also a possibility. So,
on your,
excuse me?
You need to read the entire thing because it needs to include the 30 minutes.
Oh, I do that.
And there's no virtual option.
Oh, no, not to the executive session, but when we come back. Okay. All right, it is now, what did I say? It is now 10:17. And the board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated that the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes and will conclude at 10:47. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Okay, commission recessed. Commission is recessed.